This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
This week, we spoke with Roderick Ireland, former Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. It's the first in-depth interview he's granted since his retirement this summer. He's now at Northeastern University, and we met him in a conference room there. And at first, Ireland strikes a rather imposing figure. Suit and tie, wire-rimmed glasses, salt-and-pepper hair, and a black three-ringed binder filled with carefully typed and flagged notes. It's complete with a table of contents prepping him for any possible question, sections ranging from growing up in Springfield to judicial philosophy.
Now, I have some notes. May I refer to them during the
Absolutely.
Interview?
Absolutely. As you wish. You'd expect such meticulous preparation from a man whose career contains so many firsts. The first African-American appointed to the SJC in 1997. And in 2010, Ireland became the first African-American to lead the Commonwealth's highest court since its founding in 1692.
It had a certain amount of pressure on it. On me as well, to do well, to try to make it possible to have a second and a third and a fourth person of color on the court. So I understood every day that I had to do a good job, that I was standing on the shoulders of a lot of people who worked real hard to make it possible for me to be there, and that I had a duty to try to do the very best job that I could every day.
Now, we said that Roderick Ireland strikes an imposing figure. But as you can hear, intimidation is not his style. Ireland is intelligent, warm, even self-effacing about the role he's played in pushing justice forward in Massachusetts. For example, in the early 1970s, Ireland, then a young public defender, argued a groundbreaking case before the Supreme Judicial Court that would change the way every trial in Massachusetts is conducted.
We argued that poor people had a right to have transcripts in their criminal trials. People who could afford it could hire a stenographer and they would have a stenographer. But
so that wasn't standard practice in courts
here? That was not standard practice. No, it was not.
Okay, think about this for just a moment. Before Ireland took his case to the SJC in the early 70s, the only way you could get a written record of your trial in this state was if you were rich enough to afford it. If you were poor, no transcript. I mean, it's stunning. How do you mount an appeal? How do you contest a ruling? How do you know justice has been served when there's no official documentation of what was said in court? It's one of those examples, which maybe there are still many of today, where if you can afford a certain type of legal system, right? If you're rich and you can afford it, you get a certain kind of legal system. But if you're not, you get a different one. Like, a lot of people still complain that there's a multi-tiered legal system.
Of course. When I was a young public defender, we wound up filing a lawsuit against the judges of the Roxbury District Court because they had a policy there when they would set bails on people in criminal cases. They didn't want the bails to be appealed by the lawyers. And if we appealed the bail, which was every person's right, then the judges took umbrage with that. I was the director. We filed suit against the judges of the Roxbury District Court and successfully were able to press the right of everyone, including poor people, to contest a bail that was set in a criminal case.
Were these judges mostly white?
Mostly, but not exclusively.
Ireland smiles. He knows what I'm getting at.
It was one of those things where now as an older judge, I scratch my head sometimes and I say to myself, did you really do that as a lawyer? Well, you know, challenging the status quo is something that's difficult to do, but it was the right thing to do.
So where did this combination of audacity and humility come from? Roderick Ireland was born in 1944. He grew up in a tight-knit, working-class Springfield neighborhood. His father painted houses, his mother taught elementary school, and every Sunday, he was in the pews at the Third Baptist Church.
I grew up in a community where adults had a right to correct children if they thought a child was acting up or behaving improperly. So I had neighbors, I had church folks, my parents and grandparents all had friends, and so I was one kid who had a bullseye on him at all times.
This might be a little churlish to ask, but did you act up?
Well, there were times. I remember one time, I was 13 years old, and a group of us were experimenting with cigarettes. So there was a woman in her 90s who had been on her porch and looked out and thought she saw me smoking a cigarette. So she called my grandparents, who then called my parents. So, of course, I did what any teenager would do. I denied it. I took the position that the woman who reported me was too old to see clearly. That wasn't the smartest thing I ever did.
In other words, the woman was an unreliable witness. Hints of a legal mind from the start. He also recognized how the law was used as a powerful tool for injustice. While Ireland remembers Springfield as a mostly integrated city, things were very different in the segregated South. For years, he took summer trips to Spartanburg, South Carolina, his mother's hometown.
I saw the water coolers that were labeled white and covered. I went into the movies where the black sat in the balcony and the white sat on the first floor. I went to the ballparks that were segregated, rode the buses that were segregated. And I remember being probably in 10 or 11 when Emmett Till was murdered in the South. And I remember my aunt called together all of the youngsters, myself and my cousins, and she sat us down and she cautioned us about not being disrespectful to white people. We had to make sure we didn't do anything that would provoke any kind of reaction.
At that time, were you asking members of your family, because it must have been quite a different feeling from in Springfield, were you asking, why is this happening? Why do they allow this?
Right.
And what were their answers?
Well, I guess the bottom line was that's the way it is. This is the law. I mean, it was legal.
That's not to let 1950s Massachusetts off the hook. Ireland also remembers a Springfield junior high guidance counselor telling him he didn't have the right stuff for classical high school, the city's only college prep school. Race wasn't explicitly mentioned, but it was obviously the reason. Still, his parents pushed, and Roderick Ireland did go to classical high. He went on to historically black Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, which counts Thurgood Marshall and Langston Hughes amongst its alumni. And it was during his senior year at Lincoln, he received an invitation to meet with the dean of Columbia Law School.
At the end of the meeting, he said to me, well, have you ever thought about law school? And I said, no, I haven't. He said, well, we'd like to have you come to Columbia Law School. And he said to me, you're going to have to take the law boards, but you're in.
Was there anything that he said at the time that sort of spoke to you, or was it just
He talked about the role that lawyers played and how they represented people who could not represent themselves, be the voice for the voiceless. And so that's how I got drawn to the law.
Roderick Ireland went to Columbia Law School just as the civil rights movement and protests against the Vietnam War shook college campuses. Heady stuff for a young J.D. Ireland graduated in 1969 and had intended to stay in New York, but instead returned to Massachusetts, became a public defender, and as we mentioned earlier, soon found himself arguing that groundbreaking case about court transcripts before the SJC. In 1977, Ireland became a judge. Governor Michael Dukakis appointed him to the Boston Juvenile Court in Roxbury.
Every day, there are cases that involve families that are before the court because of abuse and neglect. I mean, cases where children are abused in every way you can think of, physically and mentally, emotionally, psychologically. But the juvenile court deals with broader societal issues on top of the legal issues. So let's say you've got a kid who's in court charged with robbery, but you find out the kid is homeless, or the kid's parents have a mental health issue, or the kid's parents are involved in substance abuse, or the parent who's charged with abuse and neglect has a mental health issue and they need treatment, they need medication, or the parent has some kind of anger management issue. You see, so it's so broad. Not every person who's before the juvenile court, but many of them are the people I think of as have-nots of society. They weren't dealt a good hand.
Ireland was appointed to the Massachusetts Appeals Court in 1990, and 7 years later, he became the first black justice on the Supreme Judicial Court. And then, in 2010, citing his sensitivity about, quote, the real issues in real people's lives, Governor Deval Patrick nominated Roderick Ireland to SJC chief. So just how real are we talking about? When first appointed to the SJC, Ireland acknowledged that as a black man, he might have seen things differently than his fellow justices. How many of them had been mistaken for a parking valet? Ireland had been when he was an appellate court judge, and as he told the media at the time, he'd been wearing a tuxedo, waiting for his own car outside of one of Boston's fanciest restaurants. So he's had some experiences that are different from his colleagues on the SJC, which led him, on occasion, to starkly different legal opinions. He told us about one that came after the SJC had legalized gay marriage.
Is there a particular case in which you were in the dissent that you just felt the court was making the wrong decision?
Yes. The case was Cote Whitaker versus Department of Public Health. Several couples who lived out of state wanted to come to Massachusetts to marry. And we had a law here in Massachusetts. It was written in 1913, and the law said that if a couple's marriage was not valid in their home state, they could not come to another state and marry. So my colleagues, all six of them, relied on that law and voted not to allow out-of-state same-sex couples to come to Massachusetts to marry. Now, I took a different position, and my position was, first of all, we just said in Goodrich that marriage was something that should be available to any people who wanted to marry. I thought it was wrong to rely on this law that had been used for blocking interracial marriages. So there was a history there. So Cote Whitaker was a case. I was the dissent.
You were the sole dissent.
I was the sole dissent. Now, what makes it kind of memorable for me was that a few years later, the Massachusetts legislature voted to overrule that 1913 law. I think my dissent had a little bit to do with it.
When you're in situations like that where you really think that the court's making the wrong decision, and there is the likelihood that it might be, you know, it could be a generation before the issue is revisited, that's got to be frustrating. I mean, how do you deal with that in the moment?
Yeah, it might be frustrating, but judges can't just sit up there and say, well, I disagree with what the law is, so I'm just going to come out with a different result. You have to have a principled basis to reach your legal conclusions in cases. But you can certainly point out the discrepancies. You can point out the unfairness and hope that maybe the legislature will be persuaded in the future and maybe your colleagues in the future will be persuaded.
Now, you were the first African American appointed to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court and then the first African American chief of the court. I ask because, you know, it might be self-evident as to why it's important to have a diversity amongst justices and judges in the legal system. But I'm wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on that. Why, I presume you think it's important, and I'm just wondering why.
I think it's critically important. And, you know, all you have to do is look at Ferguson and what went on there with a police department with 53 people and only three of whom were minority, with the population being majority minority. And I think in our legal system, it's critical that in order to have the respect of the of the public in order to have respect for the rule of law, that there be diversity in the legal profession and on the bench. If we don't have diversity among those positions, the clientele that comes in will feel that these people don't represent me. They don't reflect my culture, my values, my stake in society. And I think diversity also allows for a broader collection of people to contribute to the product of justice.
Former Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Roderick Ireland. We spoke with him this week at Northeastern University, where he is now an adjunct professor of criminology and criminal justice. Ireland is also working on several other projects, including the Justice George Lewis Ruffin Society, which works to promote minorities in the legal professions.
And we'll end today with that great interview with Justice Ireland. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, and Jamie Bologna.
Tim Skoog is our technical director.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.